All right, today is June 17th, 2013. This is the first interview with Joe Salmons. Is it Salmons, Salmons?
Salmons
is fine, yeah. Okay. We're here in his office inside the University Club. My name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Joe, we've chatted a couple of times about what's going to go on here. So you sort of know the first question, which is why UW-Madison?
Sheer luck. When I came out of graduate school at the University of Texas, it was very bad time job-wise. People were not, maybe 30% were getting tenure-track positions in languages and linguistics. I got a job at Purdue University in Indiana, and it's a Big Ten institution, R1, peer institution in many ways, but Lafayette, with apologies to the people of Tippecanoe County, is not an exciting place to live. It's not a particularly, it's gotten much stronger actually since, but at that time it was still building in languages and linguistics in a lot of ways. I met and married a woman who by chance had grown up in Madison, Wisconsin, another linguist. And one day after teaching a session of fourth semester German, I went back to my office and the phone rang, and it was the chair of the German department saying, "We've just had a departure in linguistics. Would you be interested in coming up for a semester and maybe staying longer?" And I basically didn't have to go home and discuss it. I said yes. Came, had a really good visiting semester, went back for a semester. We were both able to get jobs here and have been here since. It, at the time, was maybe the most, it was pretty clearly the best place in the country to be if you do the linguistics of Germanic languages in those days, by tradition and in large part because of the work that my colleague Rob Howell had done to build the graduate student program. Grad students at that time, and I think it's still true today, were clearly the best in North America in Germanic linguistics. A remarkable set of people and a remarkable set of opportunities. But it was also a really strong place to be for reasons that we'll talk about later in terms of service and outreach. The Wisconsin idea is something that's just not shared in most parts of the country, and it has real impact on how you work and how you think and what you can do and what you should do and how you do those things. And also historically, the tradition in linguistics here, and especially in historical linguistics and the linguistics of the Germanic languages, is just unbelievable. The famous general linguist in the 20th century who taught at, studied at, spent significant time at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It's just a list that just, it doesn't stop. It's like every time we have an international conference here, I just go back and pull out the appropriate names for the topic of the conference. And goes, "Oh, that's right, Einar Haugen was here. Oh, of course, the Dictionary of American Regional English is still here. Fred Cassidy was here." And just, it doesn't matter what subfield, it doesn't matter what the theoretical framework, it's like that. So you can't say no to that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So when you were here as a visiting professor, what classes did you teach?
Introduction to German Linguistics, German 351, and a seminar on German dialectology. I smile every time I think about 351 because in those days, The Onion was a small local publication, and I had this hilarious undergraduate student who was just most offbeat personality, and she was completely unreliable, but when she did work it was just brilliant. I could never figure out what the deal was. And somebody said, "By the way, you know that she writes for The Onion, right?" And I picked up the copy of The Onion that day and looked inside, and sure enough she was a staff writer. And she said, "So, oh, now I got it." Mm-hmm. So it was an entertaining semester.
Mm-hmm. And I assume there was nothing in that semester that precluded you from wanting to come back here as soon as you possibly could.
Well, the only question at that point, of course, was getting a second position. And it was a very tight year for the college. now spousal hires and partner hires are just routine. You know it going into the process. And those days, it was a transitional period. And I know at Purdue, there were a lot of cases where they weren't doing it. They were losing good hires because of it. And we sweated it. And we were just as so. What happened was my wife had just gotten tenure. She took a sabbatical year at Purdue. We moved up here. And I didn't resign my position at Purdue. And we told them that we would return to Purdue if there weren't positions for the two of us. And at the very end of the year, they came through with a position for her. So I was very happy.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should provide a personal noun to your wife's name.
Oh, Monica McCauley, mm-hmm. Professor of linguistics. She is in Washington, D.C. right now at the Breath of Life, which is an organization that's a workshop that takes place every year dedicated to revitalizing, as the name would suggest, Native American languages. She works on Menominee and Potawatomi. And that's the other crucial piece of the story. Not only was she from here and happy to have a chance to move back to where her family lived, she, as somebody who, she'd been hired, she did a degree at Berkeley working on especially Mixtec, a Central American language, language of Oaxaca in Mexico, and worked some on California languages, but Indiana, as she always says, despite its name, has no Native American languages spoken natively. Miami was spoken there, and there's Miami folks at Breath of Life trying to revitalize it, bring it back to life. But a chance to come here, and again, it's that historical thing, you know. Leonard Bloomfield did part of his graduate work in Madison. Grew up basically in Chicago, but his family spent time, and I think he may have been actually born in Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin. Did a classic grammar of Menominee and lexicon, a collection of stories that he edited and published. So we've got this remarkable, and it's sort of the gold standard for study of American Indian languages in some ways. Completely opaque grammar, but it's just brilliant analysis. And he went and did, I don't know what it was, 3 months of field work and wrote this grammar this thick. Amazing. Mm-hmm. So when we came, she started working with Menominee, and now she's working with Potawatomi as well. So mm-hmm.
It sounds like that even if your wife wasn't from here, there would have been a pull to this institution for both of you.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And having been here now for basically 20 years, it's clearer now than it was then. I was already working with, so my Wharf professorship is named after Lester W.J. Smokey Zeifert, mm-hmm. who grew up trilingual in Juneau in Dodge County, speaking a Low German dialect. It's another language, it's not German, and German and English. And he was here after World War II. He came back from World War II and started recording German speakers around the state. And he spent his career, a lot of his career, he taught German on Wisconsin Public Television, things like that. But he spent a lot of his career going around giving public outreach talks about immigrant languages and things like that in the state. And I knew that if you were going to work on German dialects in the U.S., which was something I was interested in, that it's a chance to connect with the people of the state. And it's really interesting in Monica's field in linguistics departments, working on endangered languages. In those days, in the 80s, there was not a sense, or people were trying to figure out data that would contribute to theories of understanding how human language works. And I mean, we still do. I mean, that's what we're right at core. That's what we do mm-hmm. as linguists. But there was not the kind of sense that there is today by any means of what it is you owe to communities for the chance to work with them. So, mm-hmm. you know, these are, for German, it's not a big deal. German is ceasing to be a spoken language in Wisconsin, except for recent immigrants and people who study it. And that's not tragic. It's not seen as tragic by the speakers themselves and their children. It's an interesting thing. People say, I wish my grandfather would have spoken German to me, but it's not a fundamental feature of who they are and how they live. If you go to the Menominee Reservation or you go and talk to the Ho-Chunk, you have a profoundly different experience. And for her, making that transition at an institution that's committed to service and outreach was really, really has been valuable. Mm-hmm.
Joe, I think you've alluded to this, but I guess I'm interested to know if you think that your wife's research has helped, maybe not shaped is the right word, but helped your own research or your own interest, even though they're two.
Oh, shaped is a good word. I mean, again, it comes back to part of the what I see as the Wisconsin tradition. There's a breadth to how you have to think about linguistics, and I think how you have to think about science in general. It's possible to spend your career, I mean, you see it a lot in some of the hard sciences now, is people spend their career working on a very narrow area. Linguistics is an old science in terms of how long people have been doing it, but in terms of how far we are in understanding the real cognitive basis of human language, we're very young, we don't know very much. And the way that you make real progress there is by having a broad view of things. And so her work shapes how I think in all sorts of ways. But again, there's this Wisconsin tradition. I told you last time we talked that I listened to the interview that had been done with Hefner in the 1970s, Roe Merrill Secrets Hefner, who was a German professor here for many decades. Amazing guy. He wrote a book published by UW Press in early 50s called General Phonetics. He was a German professor. Phonetics, speech science, sure, there's some Germanists who are phoneticians, but that's a huge stretch. People still use that book. I mean, I refer to that book. I pulled it off the shelf last week to check something. It's not the cutting edge, obviously. Phonetics is completely different now than it was then, but he knew a lot and got a lot into that book. You listen to that interview with him, here's a guy who starts doing phonetics and real speech science phonetics and like the physics of speech, like what happens acoustically with sound waves. Does it across a set of languages, goes to graduate school, comes here, what does he do? He's teaching phonetics, general phonetics, so that the English, he's doing lectures and then the English students go work with Hanley, I think it was at that time, in the English department. The Scandinavian students would go and work with Haugen in Scandinavian studies and so forth, but he was doing the sort of general theoretical introductions. Does that mean he was teaching that and basic German? No, he was teaching medieval German literature, with like how far can you get from speech science to medieval literature? And the interviewer says, and I knew that about him, he'd published in it, and the interviewer says, So you know Latin well, don't you? And he said, well, yeah, of course, you have to do medieval, which is true. But you've taught some Latin. Oh, yes, of course, I teach Latin, blah, blah, blah. And he goes off and talks about teaching Latin for a while. And she says, is it true? Somebody told me that you taught physics. He said, well, yeah, they needed, it's on tape, obviously. During World War II or something, they needed faculty to teach physics, and said, well, I can't teach the advanced stuff, but if you guys can cover the advanced stuff, I'll teach the intro. And he was a phonetician, he knew the basics. Well, did you have to do much prep? Yeah, I had to go back and I had to brush up on my math and stuff. I mean, that's how you make progress. Here's this guy who's working on everything from 12th century poetry to the physics of speech to Latin. I mean, that's how you do it, and that's how we approach linguistics today. And as you look around campus, that's where the progress is coming. That's how we're doing it. Mm-hmm. From Tom Purnell, the theoretical phonologist in English, and Eric Ramey, they do hardcore phonetics. They do social linguistics. How is it that people identify themselves? Why is a Wisconsin accent what it is when you work with African Americans in Milwaukee? What parts of that Wisconsin accent have they adapted? What parts have they not adapted? And there's a physics angle to that. You've got to understand the acoustics, but there's also the real sort of socially negotiated identity that you have. All over campus it's like that. Mark Seidenberg in psychology has done really important work on psycholinguistics, but he's also interested in how that comes to bear in terms of things like kids learning to read and why there are differences in populations at academic success at low levels. Mm-hmm. That's how things have been done at Wisconsin for decades, and it's incredibly important to me and attractive. So yeah, of course we talk regularly about it.
So instead of starting with trying to get an overview of your teaching, I think what you've been talking about and what I've been asking sort of segues nicer into your research here. And you've alluded to it in some of these answers, but I wonder if you could start with an overview of your research and maybe even start, well, let's start it this way. How did you become interested in linguistics? And I'm sure that obviously predates UW-Madison, but I think it's important for us to
know. It does indeed predate it. So I grew up in Kings Mountain, North Carolina, which in those days was a cotton mill town. And at various points through high school, people talked me out of quitting high school to go to work. And so when I finished high school, I decided that I should apply to college. I applied to UNC Charlotte, which was very close by, cheap. I could keep working on the side. I went to UNCC, and I thought hard about what I wanted to study, and I decided I wanted to do really basic stuff, so I figured I would start with philosophy. And the very first orientation session, I went off with the person from the philosophy department, and he said, "So, what language are you going to specialize in?" I said, "I don't know. You've got French, German, and Russian are your main choices." I said, "Okay, I'll take German, whatever." Started taking German, but was really doing philosophy, and started taking French later. And philosophy is really interesting in all sorts of ways. History and philosophy of science are really important for what I do now, but spending a lot of time thinking about and trying to understand European philosophy. And that means that you're having to read stuff in German and French. And I decided I was going to go to grad school. I wanted to do philosophy, but it was really clear that if I didn't have extremely solid command of those languages, I was not going to be able to do what I wanted. Even if what I really wanted to do was history and philosophy of science, I really needed to know those languages, to know those traditions. So I applied for philosophy in a couple of places, and I applied in German to a couple of places, thinking that I would go and get a master's degree in German, go back to philosophy, and sort of have all the tools I really needed to do what I needed. And the place that was most interesting for both, I applied to in German, the University of Texas, Austin. And I got accepted and got funded and went there. And I was just doing the routine German classes. I mean, it means at that level, it means mostly literature. And literature, I read literature, it's fine, but it's like not something to do for a living in my view. They required a history of the German language. It was just a required graduate class. And you take languages, I don't know what languages you did, how much of them you did, but you see it when you teach basic language classes yourself. You know, it's like, why do they do it this way? What's going on here? Why is it like this? And at UNCC, I had incredibly good teachers. It was a really good time to be at a small, growing university because the job market was very tight and they were able to hire incredibly good young faculty. And there were buildings, so it was mostly young faculty. But they weren't linguists. And so as good as these people were, and great teachers knew incredible amounts, it was just like, I lived to go to class. But I said, well, why? So English used to have a dative? Why is the dative gone in English, but it's still there in German? Why does German have these weird word orders? They couldn't tell me. And it was never quite, you know, shut up, kid, pay attention to what we're talking about. But, you know, it's just like, it leaves you wanting something. So here I take this class, and from like the second or third class, this prof is explaining, okay, here's what happened in the history of German 2,000 years ago. And it separates the Germanic languages from the other Indo-European languages, and look at these patterns. It's like, oh my God, I've asked this question 20 times. It turns out every class, that whole semester, it was like things that I had been wanting to know about how German connected to English, about how English connected to French, and German connected to French, and how they all connected to Slavic. It was like he was just throwing stuff out. It was just stuff that's like, I'd been dying to know, and this guy was just casual about it. And you go up and ask him after class, and of course, you know, in those days, much more formal system. Could you accept? Well, yes, of course. It's like this. And he would just say, oh, you want to know more? There's a book on this here. And he'd write it down, and I'd go read the book. Say, oh, my God. And so at that point, it was like, okay, I can understand something that I had no clue existed in the world. I mean, I knew there was linguistics, and I knew, okay, so you can understand how grammar works and how sound patterns work, but I had no, like, actual understanding of what was going on. So at that point, there was no going back to philosophy, and I started taking classes in linguistics, Germanic in general, and that was that. And the next class I took was with a graduate of UW-Madison, Winfred Philip Lehmann, who is most famous as the author of Gothic Etymological Dictionary. And the class was called Synchronic Linguistics. So synchronics are contemporary, not historical, you know, one slice in time. And we were supposed to do a paper for the class, and he talked to us a little bit about what we were interested in, and I told him I was really interested in differences across languages, and he said, oh, you know, there are these people out in the hill country, just west of Austin, 80 miles, Fredericksburg, Gillespie County, that area, and they still speak German, and their German's changing a lot. They've been here since the 1840s, and you could go out and interview somebody and see what's going on. And that was it. I mean, today, I've got graduate students, first-year graduate students, just finished their first year, out doing field work in the, I mean, literally miles from where Smokey Zeifert grew up. But when they do it now, we sit down and go through, they have an instrument, what they're gonna interview, we talk about recording techniques, they have to have human subjects training, IRB approval, they first go with older graduate students to see, and maybe with me or other faculty, to see how we're thinking about the interviewing, what's going on. In those days, Lehmann says, well, you know, just go out there, and a lot of people speak German, you'll find some, it's no big deal. So I had a little cassette, you know, remember those old cassette recorders, whatever it is, 8 inches by 4 inches or something? I had one of those. I just grabbed it, threw it in a car, drove to Fredericksburg, got out, and walked down the street and started speaking German to people. And lo and behold, everybody either spoke German or apologized that they couldn't speak German. And so I started doing work on that. And that turned into my first article, actually. That's basically those two events essentially defined how I started in the field. Study of language change, historical linguistics, and sort of, I mean, the history of German thing leads ultimately to how language is anchored in human cognition. How is it that language changes? What's happening in your mind that makes the way you speak different from the way your parents spoke? And there's social aspects to that. There are real neurological aspects to that. And then the sort of the real world side. Edgar Bodumé, my dissertation advisor, was the guy who taught history of German. And I took that paper to him from Lehmann's class, and he just, I still have it somewhere. It's 8 typed pages back in the old electric typewriter days, courier, and it's just, he had this tiny handwriting. It was just covered, it looks like it's red edged paper because it's got so many things on it. But he told me, he said, you should come to my office, we will talk about this paper. I went, and he said, you're doing a good thing.
if you're going to study historical linguistics, you also need to know how current languages work. And it was completely right. It was still right today. You know, if you want to understand what happened 2,000 years ago linguistically, you need to understand what's happening today with languages. What's new, because there are at a certain level of abstraction, they're the same processes, the same forces at work. So, long answer to a short question.
I think there's some things I want to ask about that, but I think I want to continue.
Okay.
Continue the progression. So, you mentioned what you taught when you came here as a visiting professor. Yeah. What was your what was required of you, or what were you able to teach when you came on as a full-time faculty?
Really cool. I was able to teach all of the range of things that I was working on and interested in. So, history of German, I still teach regularly. I just published a book with Oxford on history of German. But if you do Germanic historical linguistics, a lot of the fun comes in the so-called dead languages, Gothic, Old High German, Old Frisian, Old Saxon text, in the case of Gothic, translated into Gothic in the 4th century. Our manuscripts are from the 6th century. In the case of Old High German, starts around in the 700s somewhere. You know, you've got these pieces of parchment that are written on by monks 1,200, 1,600 years ago, whatever, and runic inscriptions and stuff. So I got to teach those, which was amazing. I was so rusty on them, it was like learning them new. And slightly intimidating, because my colleague Rob Howell's like one of those guys who has like he does the so-called dead languages as well, but he has one of those memories where every single fact about Otfried uses that is somewhere, it's at the end of a line and the line starts, he's got every piece of data in his head. So that was very cool. But a lot of what they needed was contemporary theoretical linguistics. And so I worked mostly on sound patterns, so phonology, but also morphology. So I got to teach those things. Also dialectology, sociolinguistics. So really the whole range. I don't do syntax, study of clause structure, sentence structure, but that comes up enough in other places. So really, I got to do kind of everything.
So once you got here, were there classes you were able to create?
Yeah, we do a lot of topics classes. So there's no like German phonology class on the books, but there's a topics in contemporary German or whatever it's called. So you can do that and teach and teach it as German dialectology, German morphology, German phonetics and phonology, whatever. I've done it as all of those things, German sociolinguistics.
Who were some of the faculty in the department that you, Rob Howe you talked about a couple of times.
Yeah.
Obviously you knew him before you got here, at least knew of him.
I did. In fact, we first met when we were both just out of graduate school at a conference where we must have said two sentences to each other or something, but I knew who he was, knew he'd gotten the job at Madison. A few years later, his first book came out, and I was asked to review it for a journal, and I was really impressed by it. It was like a fundamentally smart book, and it's like it all ties in together. It's exactly this thing of not taking the narrow approach. He took this problem, basically a problem in the history of English sounds, and had used dialects and phonetics and phonology to understand it. And I wrote not an entirely uncritical review, but I basically wrote a review that said, if you work in any of these areas, you've got to read this. This is an incredible book. And he wrote me a letter and thanked me for the review. So yeah, by the way, my wife's from Madison. I come up sometimes and maybe we could get together sometime and have a cup of coffee. And came up on a Saturday. We got together in Van Hise and we were going to talk for a half hour. So we ended up talking for, 3 hours. and he's just like, and it's, he had built the graduate program. Smokey and folks like that were retired, and he was just a compelling teacher to this day. So he was really the most critical person there at the start. We've since hired Mark Loudon, who does German syntax. But a lot of what happens here is outside of the German department. And that's not just because of this thing of Wisconsin having this broad tradition and people who think broadly, but it's also, or maybe it is in part because of that, but it's also in part because of the nature of linguistics. In linguistics, we really have linguists across the entire campus. You know, there are people in every corner of campus who are doing work that involves a scientific study of language. Maybe they don't call themselves linguists, but they're doing linguistics. And so if you're in the language department and you want to know something about German literature, well, then you're pretty much, the German department's where it's going to be, unless there happens to be a Germanist in comp lit or something. But in linguistics, the campus is your world. And as soon as we came, in part because Monica was in linguistics, we started getting to know linguists all over campus. And I've co-authored with people in a whole bunch of different departments here and continue to work with them. Of those, the most important clearly are the linguist in English. I've already mentioned him, Tom Purnell and Eric Ramey. We worked together on something called the Wisconsin Englishes Project. but also Anya Vano in English as well. She's worked with Monica and me and Rajiv Rao in Spanish on the linguist list. Do you know what the linguist list is? Linguistlist.org. It's the world's largest academic website. It's like 25,000-30,000 subscribers. And we do the book reviews for them. We edit book reviews for Linguist List. The fact that you can have those kinds of very open collaborations and constant collaborations is another, it's something that linguists all over the country do. I was doing it at Purdue. But it's something that combined with the kind of traditional Wisconsin atmosphere gives you additional opportunities, really good additional opportunities.
Joe, did you have, I didn't check to see this, did you have tenure when you came here? Is that part of the package?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I got tenure at Purdue, and Monica got tenure just before she moved.
Okay, thank you for that. Sure. So when you came here, Rob had the graduate program, as you said, in great shape. Do you start to get graduate students working under you immediately? How does that work?
Yeah, almost immediately. I mean, it's not the way it is in the if you're a biologist, then it's sort of expected that you're going to fund students and you kind of interview students, bring them in with funding. In those days, much more than today, graduate students were basically teaching assistants, and as soon as you come in, you start teaching. They decide who they want to work with, and my first semester I did history of the language, and I started working, advising students as soon as they started making decisions about who they were going to work with. But really, in a lot of cases, and it's still true to this day, and it's especially true again with Rob, our interests are close enough, our teaching is close enough, that there are cases where I've been a dissertation director and he's really been, as you know, essentially a co-chair or maybe even had the more important role, and there are cases where it's the other way around. So it takes a village thing. You can't, you know, you don't want to be engaged in intellectual cloning. You know, you don't want to create people who do exactly or think exactly the way you do. And you need a set of folks around to work with them. But yeah, I started started having grad students at that point.
And this may segue to teaching. I'm not quite sure though how to say it. But let's start with grad students. So how do you see your role, and I guess I would say as teacher slash mentor slash advisor to grad students, how does that fit into what you do?
That's actually a really good question. So with the Wisconsin Englishes Project, Tom and Eric and I, one of the things that we've been arguing pretty explicitly in grant proposals, and we have a publication that is just in production right now, that if you're doing it right, the differences between research and teaching and outreach get to be very, very blurred. I mean, sure, when you're in the classroom talking to a set of graduate students, yeah, you can say that's primarily teaching, but that better be about research in a very fundamental way. Those people better be learning to do research and understand research. And they also better be coming away with a sense of what it means to do outreach and service, because you have to do that to survive today. And what we're doing is we're trying to bring our students along in all three sort of at once. How do you get them from the beginning to engage in original research? When I was a graduate student, it was just sort of, I was just lucky. I just, you know, Lehmann said, go out and talk to the Germans in the Hill Country. And wow, it turned out to be an incredibly smart piece of advice, like many things Lehmann said. And it led to publications and job talks and things that were really important professionally. But you, if you're going to be a successful graduate student, and even these days increasingly, and including in language departments, a successful undergraduate student, you have to start learning how to do original research. It's not, I got an email, I guess a week ago, from a kid, never even said where he was from, saying, I've been reading about, he's a high school senior, I've been reading about linguistics, I really want to do linguistics, I've taught myself this language and that language, and I'm really good at Latin, but like, it looks like the only thing you do if you become a PhD in linguistics is you teach linguistics, and I'm really scared because everybody says that you have to get tenure, and that means they're doing creative research, and like, that sounds really dangerous. No, kid, it's not dangerous. It's like there's a million things out here, and we've got a whole group of people. What we do is we bring you into the group, we teach you how to do stuff, you basically apprentice with us, you start participating in the discussions. We have discussions, we sit around this table every week and talk about what we're doing, say, with regard to Wisconsin English. What the current results look like, what kinds of analysis we're doing, why we're doing it that way, how we can improve it. New kid comes in, they can very quickly, there are all sorts of things that, okay, you need something you can do, here's something, and here's how it fits into the bigger picture. It brings them along very quickly. And so now it's completely routine. I had three, it's too many, and it, not normal, but this semester I had three PhD students finish. And all of them have serious publication records already. That's what you have to do today. And you have to be thinking, that's the mindset you have to have. You have to be figuring out how to advance knowledge. And you know, sometimes it's big ways, sometimes it's small ways. So the research teaching connection is pretty clear at the graduate level. And I really, more than people realize, it's there at the undergraduate level, and it's going to continue to be there and to grow at the undergraduate level. So you think, well, what about service? Well, if you look over your shoulder, you'll see that there's a poster called Documenting Wisconsin Heritage, German Language and Culture. I had, a year ago, with war funding and some matching funds, I was able to hire three graduate students to go up to the area basically between Lake Winnebago and Lake Michigan. Lots of German speakers up there, lots of different dialects, lots going on. These three students, Allison Sewell, Ben Fry, who just graduated, and Joshua Basquet, who just graduated. Ben's going to a postdoc at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Joshua's accepted a tenure-track position at the University of Georgia. Ben's position should become a tenure-track position. Allison's taking her prelims in a couple of months, so it's nice. she's hot on their trail. So they were doing this work. they made over 100 recordings in a semester. Amazing amount of work, a huge amount of analysis, going back listening to Smokey's old recordings, going back and listening to recordings that were made in the 60s and so on. And we're talking about, well, God, these people are asking all these questions, like, what happened to Germany? Like, why? So I talk different from these people in this next town over. It's like, they're really interested in this. Yeah, well, you know, you can do something. You can go and do presentations in those communities and tell people. So we appreciate all the interviews. We appreciate all the discussions. Here's what we were doing. Here's what we were looking for. Here's what we found. They wrote a grant to the Wisconsin Humanities Council, got funding to put together the presentations, did a set of community presentations, initially funded by the WHC, produced this poster, produced some archives, and are doing stuff that's going to show up on the web very soon. They're still doing presentations off of what they got there. So these guys, like, I had no idea when I was a graduate student that you could do that, let alone that somebody would give you money, mm-hmm. or that there was value in that. Well, you know, around here, if you say, you know, communities are interested in what we're doing in those communities, and we'd like to, our students would like to go back and talk about what they're doing in those communities, then that resonates. I mean, at Purdue and at Texas.
Wisconsin takes you my life. We need to go over to the
You know, at Purdue and at Texas, that stuff happened, and people knew it, and they valued it, but it was all like peripheral vision. It was not, it didn't have the same role. And here, you know, I mean, I know that, you know, that things have ebbed and flowed in certain ways, but, so maybe part of it's a happy historical accident, but, you know, now if you say Wisconsin idea and there's some substance behind it, that works for people. And that's a, you think, well, yeah, so it's quaint old Germans who used to talk German, that's nice. It doesn't really have any value. But it has value, it has real value in ways that you don't expect. So another graduate student who wasn't my student, she worked with Monica Chavez and did second language acquisition, Miranda Wilkerson. She's now a professor at Columbia College in Missouri. I had, with some a little bit of war funding some years ago, I had a chance to hire a project assistant, and I wanted to start finding out how to do, what was going on with some of these Wisconsin German communities historically, not how they, what they spoke today or how they spoke, but what was, so these German immigrants came, and today their descendants are basically all English speaking. What happened? And it came in part from outreach talks I'd been doing for a long time around community groups. You know, you go to the, you know, Mayville and just name a little Mineral Point. Every town has historical societies. I mean, it's a much greater density than most of the country. People, I mean, you know this as an archivist. People are engaged. People in the communities, and you've got local history, and you think maybe there are people who think, oh, well, local history, that's parochial. No, if you want to understand what real people's lives were like, go to the people who know the stuff the best, and those are the people who know the stuff the best. And so I started in the, not long after I got here, late 90s, I started doing outreach talks, especially about language and immigration, about German settlement, about German dialects in Wisconsin, stuff like that. One question that came up pretty regularly was, so when my grandfather came to Manitowoc in 1887, he learned English and he didn't expect any help. How come those Mexicans today don't do that? Well, I knew half of the answer to that. I knew there's already in the 90s, there was a huge body of research and it's grown, and there's nothing that contradicts it as far as I know in serious research. Immigrants today, however they come, whatever they're doing, however they get here, wherever they are killing themselves to learn English. They are doing every single thing they can to learn English. So when those questions first came up, and it was not every talk, but it was a regular question, and not always formulated exactly that way, and it wasn't always a grandpa from Manitowoc. And sometimes it was a question that they would wait and ask in private after the talk rather than ask it in public. But it was a clear topic. But I had started looking around for literature on when immigrants, like say German immigrants, to the U.S., like say Wisconsin, started learning English. Did they really get off the ship Tuesday afternoon in Manitowoc and wake up Wednesday morning speaking perfect English? Well, no, because that's not psycholinguistically possible. And I knew that in Wisconsin, over the 19th and 20th centuries, there were over 500 newspapers and magazines published in German. So I knew, if you wanted to read stuff, you didn't have to do it in English. And I knew that state government materials were published in German for a long time. So you didn't have to, and you could vote without speaking English. So I knew you weren't excluded from the political process if you didn't know English. But really, practically, it seemed like you have to know English to get around. Even in the 19th century, even in Sheboygan or even in Dodge County. And so I started looking for data. It turned out there was almost nothing about it. It was little bits and pieces, a couple of really tantalizing things. And one of them showed that in the 1910 census, I had worked with different kinds of census data, but I'd never thought about this particular aspect of it. 1910 census, there is column 17, which is whether able to speak English, if not, give language spoken. So it doesn't say, are you bilingual? Do you speak English and Dutch? Do you speak English and Yiddish? It says, can you speak English or not? And if you don't, what language? Miranda and I were bouncing around ideas for projects for her to do for her PA ship. I said, this is a question that's always bothered me, but I was in my 40s at this point, it was the early 2000s, census records are just, you can get them on ancestry.com, but it's just hard on my eyes. I can't, to do this quantitatively, to go through a whole census district and see how many people reported that they couldn't speak English, that would just kill me. She said, oh, I don't mind doing that, I'll do that. I said, so what should we do? I said, tell you what, why don't we do this? So the question, so we know there are going to be German monolinguals in 1910 in Wisconsin, because there were people who'd only arrived a few years before. It trickled at that point, but there were still people. Mm-hmm. So the question was, were there people who had arrived 30 years before who report not learning English? Were there people born here who report not learning English? What's going on? And so she says, what do we do? Well, let's talk it through. Nobody's done this, so we're making it up. So we just got our map of Wisconsin. We picked a few places where we thought where we might find concentrations of German monolinguals. And we picked a range of things. We picked part of Sheboygan, for example. We picked a variety of communities up and down the eastern Lake Michigan shoreline, inland a ways, and so on. And so Miranda, with the energy and eyesight that only a young person can have, goes and starts doing it. He's instantly coming back with piles of data. It's amazing. In all of these places, we're getting 10, 12, in one case, 24% English monolinguals. So I don't know how well you know Dodge County, but Hustisford is a town, a village in Dodge County. 1910, Hustisford reported being 24% German monolingual. So that's interesting. And we decided what data we would get. Where were you born? Where were your parents born? If you immigrated, what year did you immigrate? And so it turns out that we started looking at some of these communities, and the monolinguals were not people who had gotten there 2 years before. They weren't people who had gotten there 10 years before. They were people who were born here in a lot of cases. So 35% of the people in 1910 who were monolingual Germans in Hustisford, according to the census, were Wisconsin born. So they weren't learning English immediately. And Ben Fry, who I mentioned just a minute ago, just finished his dissertation on the shift from German to English in Wisconsin and the shift from Cherokee to English in Western North Carolina. He did work up in this area between Lake Winnebago and Lake Michigan. And there he found a community where almost 30% of the community, almost 30% was monolingual in German in 1910. And the majority of those people were born in this country. So here's a case where something that looks like it doesn't matter. Who cares when these Germans learn to speak English? I mean, really, they, as one guy said, I did a historical talk in Western Dane County a few years ago, and I gave the Hustisford example, and this old guy comes up to me afterwards and says, I used to work in Dodge County, and I did the rounds some. I did some sales work. I went to Hustisford a whole lot. So, oh, really? So you know Hustisford? Yeah. They turned out to be good Americans in the end. I was like, yeah, that's kind of the point, I guess. So you've got all this rhetoric about the good old immigrants who, like, you know, like sort of magically learned English. And we know the contemporary situation. So here's this thing that seems like it is not going to have any real relevance. And I mean, I can give you a set of quotes of political figures and media figures, and you probably have your own set, saying, oh, the good immigrants, that was the day back when they knew they had to learn English, unlike the people today. No, in fact, it's exactly the opposite. So we're able to establish this stuff by doing some work. And it's work. This is work that has real outreach stuff. I've got a phone interview with a woman from Univision this afternoon about this very stream of research. It was teaching. Miranda was a graduate student. We published an article in 2008. Just had another one come out this past year. We've got another one that's under review. I assume it'll come out, that sort of laying out the data for this. So that's research, teaching, and outreach all together right there in a single little chunk.
So it's, I mean, from what you told me there in those two anecdotes, in your mind, it's those three, so the three legs of the stool that we like to say for faculty are,
yep,
you know, research, teaching, service slash, yep, outreach. Those not only are more intertwined, they should be more intertwined.
Absolutely. And there are easy ways to make that happen. In the spring, I'm going to teach a class called Language and Immigration in Wisconsin. Not just German, language and immigration in Wisconsin general. We've got excellent people who know about language and immigration issues across campus. Ben Marquez in political science he's not interested particularly in language, but he's interested in other pieces of this. Kathy Stafford in Spanish, she's relatively recently tenured. She works on heritage Spanish in this area and so forth. And that's going to be an undergraduate class, no prerequisites. And the goal of that class is going to be to see, okay, new undergraduates at this university with no particular skill set, what can you figure out about language and immigration in the history of Wisconsin? So taking that beyond the graduate level to get undergraduates engaged in that kind of original research. And that stuff, I mean, some of it I'm sure will lead to publications. It's just so easy to find things. There's so little understood about this that almost anything you do, if you do it reasonably well, it will lead to publications. But in the meantime, we can put that on the web. We've got a couple of websites going already. Whatever they find out that sheds light on how language has worked in Wisconsin, is working in Wisconsin today. So this, yeah, it has to be the obvious next step is to take it to that beginning undergraduate level, and that's in the sense of the undergraduate research scholars, because it's not just if you're in chemistry, how do you get into a good lab, how do you find a good functioning lab culture. That's the same in the kind of work that we do. Students, I mean, as much as I am still in awe of my graduate school professors and my undergraduate school professors, the preface to my new history of German is basically about how my advisor made me into a historical linguist and what a debt I owe him. Still, in graduate school, I learned at least as much from my fellow graduate students as I did from my professors. And graduate students know that. That's how the world is. How do we create that environment? How do we make that go? You know, for all the discussion about MOOCs and stuff, that's, I mean, it's slick. People are tossing money at that kind of stuff. That's not the only way to make progress. And sure, yeah, of course we all do blended learning of various sorts in various ways. And you've got to change. But part of it is, how do you really make it count at the end of the day? I mean, do you make it count by having 12,000 people enrolled in your MOOC? Or do you make it count by having an outcome be that we now understand something about language in New Holstein, Wisconsin that we didn't understand before? And that we have people who are like going out and explaining to their relatives and the folks back home, oh no, actually here's what happened in our community as the with immigration. Here's the role that World War I played and didn't play in people switching to English. Here's what's happening with the state laws about schools and English. So yeah, it's got to be done, and it can be done, and most of it is sort of in progress, I would say.
Joe, we're just about an hour, so I want to give you space if there are things that your discussion or my questions and your answers have led to things that you want to make sure you get on the record.
No, I mean, those are those are good questions. There's a lot. I mean, you know, obviously this is the world. This is what I do. You got to the real fundamental, and that is what's the big picture of how education works and what faculty's role is in education, and that will tie when we talk about what happened with the protest. It will tie in pretty basic ways, actually.
Great. And I think we'll, if we don't get to that on Wednesday, when we meet next, we'll get to it in our third session. So Joe, I want to thank you for your time today. Appreciate it.
Happy to do it.